nationally recognized and with world singers, the Des Moines Metro Opera is gearing up for their 47th summer festival season, which runs from June 28th through July 21st. I'm Jacqueline Hall Bloom for the Iowa Arts Showcase. Joining us today is the Des Moines Metro Opera's General and Artistic Director, Michael Eagle. And thank you so much for coming in, Michael.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure to be here and to converse with you about our upcoming season.
Well, you have a lot on your plate, and it opens with La Boheme on June 28th. And you also have seven debut artists in this, including a new conductor. So tell us a little bit about this production.
Well, there's never a more perfect opera to program than La Boheme. It's a surefire success, probably the most quintessential opera of all operas. When people think of what this art form is, I think many people, what they might conjure in their mind's eye is this beautiful love story of a poet and a seamstress in 19th century Paris, sort of consumed by passion and doomed by fate and surrounded by the most gorgeous melodies ever written. It really is what opera is all about. It's an opera that was written by Giacomo Puccini in 1896 and really launched him to international fame, launched him on to compose other works like Tosca and Madama Butterfly. But La Boheme, for which he is best known and for which he has earned his international reputation, it's been a perennial hit from its premiere to today. And so we're always glad when we can turn to it. At Des Moines Metro Opera, we've seen such an influx of new and first-time attendees to our productions recently that it makes sense to turn to this quintessential work more often than others, although it has been, I think, about 8 years since the last time we did it. And I'm thrilled to do it again in a beautiful production with a cast that includes mostly debut artists, as you mentioned. It's not often when we can look up and down the list of a group of artists and see that most of them are making their debuts with us. This is a wonderful opera to introduce talented young singers with. And as you mentioned, we have a debut conductor, Michael Christie, who recently won a Grammy Award for conducting the opera about the life of Steve Jobs just this last spring. So we're thrilled for Maestro Christie to make his debut with us conducting Boheme.
Tell us about who some of your principal singers are. They have amazing backgrounds.
You know, my hobby is to travel around the United States listening to the next crop of rising young singers coming out of major conservatories and competitions in the United States. That's not to say we don't often feature veteran and established artists too, but there's that strata of artists in there that I think are just coming to attention. And an opera so focused on youth and young love and springtime is, I think, gives us a perfect opportunity to showcase some of the best of my finds from recent audition trips. Julie Adams is our Mimi, a graduate of the San Francisco Opera. They've done much to give her experience and an opportunity. Of course, she's done many things already around the United States, but I think this is a major talent. Her Rodolfo, the tenor poet, is Joshua Guerriero, whom I heard sing last summer in the Santa Fe Opera in Madama Butterfly, and I knew that he was the singer we wanted for Rodolfo this summer. Manye Goloyan is our Musetta, recent graduate of Houston Grand Opera Studio, and also has done many things since that time, and I think a rising young star. She'll sing that pivotal aria Quando Men Vo, which comes up in Act Two and might arguably be the most famous melody in the entire show, maybe in the entire operatic canon. And then her Marcello is Thomas Glass, baritone from the Houston Grand Opera Studio, who was just named one of the, I think, top five national finalists from the Metropolitan Opera National Council auditions. So we have a quartet of young lovers at the head of this show that are all very much celebrated and of whom many big things are expected. So I can't wait to showcase them all together this summer in Boheme.
And who is the stage director for this?
Our stage director is Octavio Cardenas, who has been a stage director with us for many years on our staff and has led a number of our acclaimed second stages productions, like The Tenderland at the Maytag Dairy Farms last year, Galileo Galilei that we did at the Science Center, Rappaccini's Daughter that we did at the Greater Des Moines Botanical Garden. He's done wonderfully imaginative things in all kinds of indoor and outdoor spaces, and he's thrilled to finally be directing a mainstage opera inside, whether it won't hopefully be an issue.
Give us a bit of a synopsis.
Well, it plays in four acts, but it's very concise. In many ways, you could call La Boheme the most perfect opera because I don't think there's a wasted note or a wasted moment. Throughout the creation of this art form for hundreds of years, the argument was always about words or music, which was more important, which wasn't. And when we get to 1896 in La Boheme, we finally get to that point where moments of incidental dialogue alter back and forth between grand melodies, beautiful songs, familiar tunes, with so much ease that you barely notice when you're going from one to the other. And that was the kind of fusion that composers strove for many, many years. This is the quintessential story of bohemian life in Paris in the 19th century. A group of four guys, a poet, a painter, a musician, and a philosopher lived together, writing poems and music and then throwing them into the stove to keep warm in cold Parisian winter. Suddenly on Christmas Eve, there's a knock at the door and a beautiful young seamstress is at the door asking to have her candle relit to stay warm by. And as opera would have it, as luck would have it, it's love at first sight between Rodolfo the poet and Mimi the seamstress. Then they immediately embark on a very up and down love affair. Because it's opera, there's always a twist, and we discover very early on that all may not be well with poor Mimi's health, and come to find out she is consumptive. And so the handwriting is a little bit on the wall, but the beauty of the story and the twists and turns will surprise and move and delight audiences, regardless of whether they're seeing it for the first time or experiencing it kind of cozying back up to it like an old friend. It's one of those pieces that never fails to move and inspire and delight audiences.
And you're also going to do a Bernstein piece, and what a great time to do this as well.
We're actually just 1 year past Bernstein's centennial now, and I like to kind of be a little bit outside the beaten track, so we're programming Candide in the year after the Bernstein's centennial. I have had this fascination with programming our next two works side by side for quite some time. And I am thrilled that this is the year that we get to do it. Two towering pieces of the 20th century that, to my mind, are almost diametrically opposed to one another. And you mentioned Candide, or optimism, as they say in the book. I'm thrilled to return to this work. As it turns out, to my surprise a little bit, when we did an audience survey, this was the piece that came in as the number one most requested piece, tied with the Pearl Fishers. I was delighted because as a producer, you're constantly an opera really programming with great forethought your comedies because you can run out of them so easily. The serious operas outnumber the comedies so much that you have to really be mindful of when and how you're programming those comedies. So I was glad to see that that was in our audience's mind because it was also in my mind as well. And I'm thrilled for Candide to return after, I think it's been probably 15 or 20 years since the last time we did it. So we're grateful to have it back.
Operas have so many plot twists, but this opera has even more, I think, to try to understand it and keep up with what's happening and where they're headed and all of that.
Right. So this piece is based on a biting little satire published in 1759 in France by the great French philosopher and writer Voltaire, who kind of set after satiring, skewering every aspect of modern French society, from religious philosophy to societal events to social orders. Everything was fair game, but most of all was this kind of Enlightenment era philosophy that because this was the only possible world, therefore it stood to reason that it was also the best of all possible worlds. And he took that as a pretty naive and simplistic view of life and set about kind of telling a story that would skewer that as well. I recently reread the book. It's not very long. I think it's maybe 100 pages or so, an afternoon's read. And as I was going through it, one thing kept coming to my mind, which is, I can't imagine what in the world would make someone read this little novella and think that it should be set to stage. It's full of complicated plot twists and characters that come and go like a Saturday Night Live skit in a sense, and it kind of bumbles around, jostling its hero, its title character Candide, all about Europe and off to the New World and back again through trials and tribulations and earthquakes and war and strife and all in an effort to sort of come to somewhat of a moral conclusion at the end. But in the meantime, it's filled with wild and fun, popular, classical, jazz, wonderful music that delights and energizes. It's a thrill to bring this piece back to the stage.
Tell us about some of the stars that will be in this cast.
Well, it's a huge cast, many people playing multiple roles, you know, one of those sorts of things. We have Candide, a debut artist, Jonathan Johnson, whom I've discovered at the Lyric Opera of Chicago in the Ryan Opera Center there. Our Cunegonda, his heroine, is Diana Braywick. She made her debut with us a few seasons ago as Nanetta in Falstaff and had great success. I knew immediately we wanted to bring her back for this role back in 2016. Robert Orth, who is a veteran of operetta stage, comedic roles, has done the role of Dr. Pangloss numerous times around the United States, is coming to be our Dr. Pangloss. The old lady who has the famous tango that comes towards the conclusion of Act One will be sung by Jill Grove. Jill made her debut with us last season as the witch Jezibaba and Rusalka, and we knew we wanted to have her back right away. Fun and outrageous personality. Audiences just really enjoyed her very much, so we're thrilled for her to return. Maximilian will be sung by Emmett O'Hanlon, who debuted with us a few seasons ago in Billy Budd. And Paquette is Eliza Bonnet, another former apprentice artist who's making her main stage debut. And then the cast list goes on. I think it's two or three pages long, just to encompass all of the different scenes and countries and cities that the opera encompasses. What a wild and wacky tale this is.
Fill in a few of these blanks about this plot.
Well, Candide is a youth who's growing up in Westphalia, much in love with the daughter of his master, the Baron Thunder Ten Tronckh. And he and Cunegonde, Maximilian and Paquette wake up every morning in a beautiful castle in the best of all possible worlds to have all of the greatest tutelage and to learn and to sort of live their privileged life. And all seems to be proceeding exactly as they might have expected in their sort of porcelain world until suddenly a battle erupts and Candide is conscripted into the army. Murder and plague and shipwreck and earthquake happen, and our characters are murdered and mayhem ensues, and then they're brought back to life, all sort of tongue-in-cheek with the idea that it's more make-believe than reality. It's a story in which nobody is safe. Bernstein was first encouraged to set this to music by the great playwright Lillian Hellman, who regarded it as one of the great works of satire, probably the greatest satire ever written, that it hit out in all directions and sort of skewered all human nonsense, as she said, probably thinking of her own experience at the hands of the Congressional Committee headed by Senator McCarthy in the 1950s. And of course, Bernstein himself, being very familiar with that, saw parallels in Voltaire's time in the 1750s with their own time in the 1950s. And so the opera, in a sense, becomes a little bit of a satire of 1950s America. Of course, we know Bernstein for having written West Side Story, his greatest work for the stage, arguably. And I think there are people who maybe think that Candide is second in line to the greatness of West Side Story. And I would only disagree just a little bit with that. West Side Story had a much more fortunate beginning in its certainty as a debut as a Broadway musical, and sort of knew exactly what it was from its very get-go. Candide, one of the greatest things about it is the fact that you have the wonderful traditions of American and European musical heritage living seamlessly side by side with each other. You have popular and classical idioms from tangos, waltzes, sitting right next to jazz riffs and dance motives and all sorts of things. The score really moves from one to the next so brilliantly that it's a remarkable work. And I think that it does belong on a par with all of Bernstein's great pieces, and particularly West Side Story. I think it is definitely its equal. It premiered on Broadway, but was really pretty much more of an operetta, I think, from the beginning. And Bernstein tried numerous times through his life, through the help of Lillian Hellman and Hugh Wheeler, Harold Prince, and Stephen Sondheim and others, to kind of make it more and more suitable to the Broadway stage. Before his death, though, in 1988, he kind of embraced its role as an opera, and John Macheri created what Bernstein called his final word, his final version of Candide after many versions, which is fondly referred to as the Scottish Opera Edition. And that's the edition we'll be performing this summer, tailored for opera houses. And I think Bernstein brings all the energy and the fun and all of the wonderful things about American traditions kind of beautifully intertwined with European traditions. And to me, that's one of the things that makes this score so special, is that these idioms are really living so beautifully next to one another inside of one piece.
So what is the moral of the story? What did Candide learn after this incredible journey he went on?
Of course, the finale of the piece is called Make Our Garden Grow, and it's a very famous choral number. It's a beautiful way to end the piece, but I think the moral of the story ultimately is that there's very little that one can do to kind of battle the things that life throws your way, except to plant your seed and work the ground and use your hands and put in your honest day's work and lead an honest life. That's the most surefire and best way to kind of deal with whatever life throws your way.
For this production, you have a new stage director, and then David Neely will be on the podium.
So this is a new production from top to bottom, brand new costumes, brand new set, and a new creative team. Michael Schell is our director, Stephen Kemp is our scenic designer, and Linda Pisano is our costume designer. I met with them first over a year ago and engaged them to do this production, and I knew it would be living opposite Wozzeck in our season, and I wanted to play up the contrast between the two pieces. So I said, create me a production of Candide that is fun and energetic, that makes it easy for the audience to track all of the different changes of location. We start in Germany, we're in Lisbon, Paris, Venice, Buenos Aires, Cadiz, Suriname. I mean, the list goes on and on. From one minute to the next, you're in a different country. I said we need to be able to track that. And then last of all, I want it to be colorful. Well, this creative team came up with a beautiful way of marrying all of those things, and that is that each of the different cities represented, each of the different countries, is done in a very bright, singular hue. So Paris is pink, Cadiz is blue, Buenos Aires is green, the golden paths of El Dorado are made out of gold, and Venice is orange, and the very innocent first scene in Westphalia when our characters first start out is all in white. And then pieces of the journey kind of remain on the stage as we go, so that at the end, when we get to make our garden grow, you see the kind of pastiche of all of the cumulative travels that Candide has had, and you'll get a very technicolor, beautiful experience. It's a new way to solve that problem of all of those locations that I'm anxious to see play out on stage, and promises to be a real delight visually. And it's a very convoluted plot with all kinds of spoofs and bumbling about from country to country, and you may follow it and you may not, but I remember having seen Candide numerous times, and the first time I had no idea what was going on, and I loved it nonetheless. So it's really kind of immaterial. You'll hear beautiful music, and of course the dialogue is hilarious, so you'll have a wonderful time regardless.
Tell us about this incredible piece that you're going to be adding to the season as well.
So our premiere piece, this piece that we've never done before, is Alban Berg's great masterpiece, Wozzeck. I think it's safe to say that it will be the most challenging piece we have ever attempted musically. It premiered on December 14th, 1925, so it's coming around to be 100 years old. It is an expressionistic piece of music, which means to me, when I think of visual art and expressionism, the thing that I immediately think of is Edvard Munch's great painting, The Scream. If that is expressionism and art, then Wozzeck, this opera, is expressionism, that same sort of movement in music. I mentioned that it's nearly 100 years old, and yet the thing I think that I find the most surprising about the piece is how modern it feels. Every time we take on a new piece, the joy for me of learning new things or certain aspects that really stick in my mind as I begin to continue to read and familiarize myself with the piece is special surprises. This one, my first real big reckoning was that this is almost 100 years old, and yet it will sound to audiences very modern, shockingly modern, and very contemporary. The other thing is the story itself, which is based on a play by a German playwright, George Büchner, which is itself almost 200 years old. I like to say this is the piece when opera became modern. It is certainly a serious drama. It is just a short piece. It's only 90 minutes long, three acts performed without break, 90 total minutes that includes some of the most remarkable and interesting and unique music ever written. It was Berg's singular opera. Berg is from that atonal school from the 1920s, and beginning of the last century, in which composers began to believe that every possible language of harmony had been exhausted, and that the only way forward was disharmony or atonality, music sort of as formula, as mathematic equation, rather than as melodic expression. And Berg really creates the most incredible version of this type of opera, the quintessential kind of piece that people point to as modern opera. It will certainly be the hardest thing that the orchestra has ever played, and it is an extremely intense story. It was Berg's first opera written, as I mentioned, in December 1925, and first performed in Berlin. And there are always pivotal moments, not just in music, but in all of cultural life, where you can really point to a singular event, a gallery opening, a debut of a painting, a debut of a novel, opening night of a musical piece, an opera, where the trajectory of culture kind of goes into a new direction. And the opening night of Wozzeck in 1925 was certainly one of those nights. Alban Berg was a young 40-year-old composer who had written just a few pieces. Of course, he wrote a great string quartet, some piano music and solo songs, but he was commissioned by the Berlin Opera to write this opera at the age of 40. And it was one of those nights where the press was there, political figures were there, society was there, everybody was there. And the screams and cheers of support and the jeers of those who found it just too much to take were so much so that it was just absolute cacophony in the opera house after it was over. And writers always tell the story of the tall, slender Alban Berg coming to the stage as a relatively unknown 40-year-old person and standing in the middle of it very serenely and taking his bow, knowing that he had really just kind of changed the course of Western music with this great opera. What a night, what an event to think of, and really changed the direction of where everything was going culturally.
You have two of my favorite performers in this opera. Tell us about the cast.
The idea to do Wozzeck is never one that a person undertakes lightly. We will be one of a very small handful of companies in America that has ever done this piece. Certainly the only company not in one of the very largest of metropolitan cities to have taken it on, I feel safe in saying. And there's only a few reasons why one would do it. And the first is that we have somebody who must sing Wozzeck, who really has to do that next. And that is baritone Michael Mays. He has kind of become synonymous with Jake Heggie's Dead Man Walking, which he has done all over the world now. Many, many times. Of course, he didn't do it with us. He's done other things with us. But a few seasons ago, he came out and did Soldier Songs with us in January in Camp Dodge. He is a method actor, and he throws himself into roles so completely and so movingly that he just absolutely breaks audiences' hearts with drama and with what he's able to do on stage. And I was sitting there thinking, what does he need to do? He's really kind of coming to the point where he needs to retire Dead Man Walking and think about what the next step is and what is that role. We need to bring him back in to our main stage in a piece. What would I program for him? And it just kind of dawned on me that that raw energy, that ability to just deconstruct himself psychologically in front of an audience was a perfect suit for this role of Wozzeck, this man who society and the military and his own paranoia just sort of gang up on right before our very eyes, and we just kind of watch him crumble. And I thought, this is the perfect role for Michael Mays, and it's coming to the point where the orchestra is ready to play it, and I have a director who can direct a marvelous production of it. So the stars kind of lined up, and I said, this is the time for us to take on this most difficult piece.
And then his counterpart, Sarah Gartland.
So we needed somebody who was really touching, that could bring pathos and sympathy and yet strength and vocal beauty to this role. And I thought and thought and thought about it. And last summer when she sang Rusalka for us, there were qualities in that performance that I knew she could bring to Marie that would be really touching. And I wanted somebody who dramatically could hold the stage with Michael Mays and would make a very strong pairing vocally and dramatically. And I think we have two marvelous singers and two marvelous actors in Sarah Gartland and Michael Mays for these two leading roles.
And you're so right about both of them throwing themselves into the part. It'll be very, very powerful.
Just riveting performers and gorgeous singers, and I think that's going to make it quite a special experience.
Tell us a little bit about this plot and what it means.
It's a story that I think echoes a little bit of World War I. But that being said, it isn't about World War I. We always see it done in that way, or even World War II. You know, we kind of see it costumed or performed in that period. But as I mentioned, the thing that was so surprising to me is that it was actually written 100 years before then, so very forward-looking for the 1820s when the play first came out. It is the story of what happens to a soldier through the course of some pretty unfortunate events. The piece, the play, the opera is a very powerful indictment, I think, of military brutality, kind of demonstrating the unraveling of social pressures that might lead an ordinary man to acts of violence. It's a story that makes me think of many of the stories we see today relating to PTSD and the effects that combat has and military service has on those who have served and those who have been called to serve for us. And so in that sense, it feels very contemporary to me and I think has a special resonance, even though it is, as I mentioned, 200 years old. It's a piece of great power, great drama, a small cast, and a piece that definitely requires a very strong visual point of view in the storytelling, in the staging, the scenic design, and the costume design, a symbolic and expressionistic piece, and I think opera connoisseurs, many would mark this for them as one of the most important and powerful pieces in really the 400-year history of the art form.
So tell us, who are your conductor and stage director and costume designer?
I mentioned that Michael Mays was one of the primary reasons for us to do it. The other two reasons for us to do this, the stars kind of aligned. Maestro David Neely and Christine McIntyre have done such incredible work together in our space. Maestro Neely, an assembling, a world-class orchestra of players who play in major orchestras around the United States. He's been slowly working to assemble our summer festival orchestra to include these types of players who are interested in playing music of this degree of difficulty and who are interested in coming to companies for their summers off that will take on enormous challenges and do so with great aplomb. So I knew that when I had heard what David had done with the orchestra in things like Flight last season and Billy Budd a few seasons ago, that the time was right to really throw this incredible musical challenge at our very, very talented festival orchestra. We have extremely talented musicians. Some of our principal players are playing principals in orchestras like the Metropolitan Opera, and they come to us because they have the summer off. You know, there's no playing, and they're looking for summer gigs, and they are interested to come to Des Moines Metro Opera because we aren't just doing your standard fare repertory. Yes, of course, we have things like La Boheme, but we're also throwing in pieces that they'll never have a chance to play other places. And so that's a big enticement to high-quality musicians to be here in the summer. And then there's Christine McIntyre, who has managed to take our very unique and intimate theater space and turn it into some of the most special theatrical experiences imaginable. And I so admire her brilliance and her thought and her work that I just knew I wanted to kind of throw this enormous challenge her way and let her have a crack at, again, one of the most difficult and interesting pieces, the kind of piece that stage directors and designers kind of salivate at the chance to get to do. And then she and I worked really hard to put together the right creative team for this opera. And our scenic designer and costume designer is Vita Tsakoun, a Georgian costume and scenic designer who happens to be married to David Adam Moore, who did Dead Man Walking for us a few seasons ago. I've always enjoyed Vita's work. She works internationally at some of the largest opera houses in the world, and we were able to entice her away from a very busy schedule to come for Wozzeck because she knew it would be one of the few times in her career she would get to design a new production of this. And Christine and I, we've done together a marvelous creative team. I think it's safe to say, Jacqueline, that it might be the first time certainly in America, first time that the piece has been directed by a woman. And I would say that it's probably one of the few, if the only times, where we've put together an all-female creative team to tell this very masculine story, sort of the decomposition or the disintegration of the male psyche under terrible acts of pressure. And we're very, very proud of that. And I'm very excited about what that team has presented to show us about this great tale.
So you mentioned earlier that you paired Vasek with Candide. Why is that?
Well, I'm always trying to think of really interesting juxtapositions of pieces, how one piece and another piece go together in the overall composition of a season, how they compare and contrast each other and kind of the tapestry of works that we're attempting to create for our audiences, many of whom are coming to see all three or four operas over the course of a weekend. And so variety or that contrast is very important. And this idea of juxtaposing these two major works of the 20th century has been a long fascination for me. As I mentioned, Candide is about optimism. Candide or Optimism is the subtitle of the book. And it's a very sunny look, if not without its travails, a very sunny look at life and a sense of very much to be celebrated and much to be joyous about. And Vosek, maybe not so much. It's a much more dramatic piece. I won't go so far as to say that it's pessimism necessarily, but I think it stands in very stark contrast to Candide. And having these two pieces kind of sitting next to each other in a season is such a great interpolation of works. I'm very excited about it. It's definitely resonating with audiences. Our ticket sales are at record highs so far in the year, and so we know that people are very interested in these types of sung stories.
So tell us about some of the other amazing events that you have as part of your season.
Well, as part of our Second Stages series, we're partnering with the Iowa Culinary Institute at DMAC and the French Chefs Program to present an evening called Bon Appetit, in which audiences will be treated to dinner and a short opera, both inspired by the great culinary icon Julia Child, as portrayed by our audience favorite Joyce Castle.
Tell us about some of the other things. You have apprentice artist scenes, you have threads and thrills, you have all sorts of really cool things in conjunction to all these marvelous operas.
There's a full calendar of events on our website, which include a number of ticketed events and free events that we offer to the community. We are a festival, so we offer programming for children. We offer free programs, lectures, other small concerts that people can take advantage of. We have a Threads and Trills costume show for something lighter at the Embassy Club downtown on June 15th. That's a ticketed event. One of my favorite events is called Picnic and Puccini, which is a family opera adventure where young people can see a performance of Little Red's Most Unusual Day, an absolutely adorable little opera for the young and the young at heart, as well as taking a tour behind the scenes of the theater and enjoying a sack lunch. That's on June 20th and 22nd, always a very popular event and great for families. We have some Young Friends Nights, which are geared towards young professionals looking to kind of get their first experience in opera, and a couple more lectures as well. On July 6th, The Curious Case of Candide, and on July 13th, Who's Afraid of Vosek, in which Maestro Neely will talk about the musical aspects of this great piece. And one of the big events of the season always is the Stars of Tomorrow concert on July 17th at Cheslow Auditorium at Drake University. It's always a popular event. It's a kind of a sampler of sorts. It features the festival orchestra, members of the apprentice program, and they are singing and performing very familiar tunes, ensembles, choruses from opera. So it's a great chance for people to kind of test out the operatic waters, as it were, at a $25 ticket price and about an hour's length concert, maybe a little bit more, and a reception afterwards. Great chance to kind of introduce people to the opera who might want a kind of a toe in the water kind of experience. And I guess the centerpiece of our summer festival this season is the grand opening of the Lauridsen Opera Center, which is kind of the home of our operatic ecosystem. It's a 1904 Carnegie Library in Indianola, which Des Moines Metro Opera has owned since the 1980s. We have undergone an extensive remodeling, restoration, and a sizable atrium expansion addressing community space and ADA accessibility concerns. I am so thrilled to be able to open this to the public this summer. There will be opportunities for opera goers to tour the facility before some of the performances, as well as some open houses and things which are available on our website. It's a stunning facility that marries the traditional with the forward-looking. Many of the old wonderful things that were part of those Carnegie libraries remain, and a very contemporary and beautiful forward-looking aesthetic in some of the new addition and some of the furnishings. And it's also become, in a sense, a gallery showcase of all of our original art, from scenic watercolors to costume designs. There's costume displays and exhibits in the new addition. It's really become an homage to a company with a very deep legacy, a very individualistic heritage and longevity that we feel very proud of. It's a chance for us to really showcase that visually to the public. And for me, it is a little bit of the maybe prelude or the overture to our movement towards our 50th anniversary coming up in about 3 years. So this kind of begins that celebration to mark that milestone in 2022.
So how can listeners get more information and tickets?
Information is always available at DesMoinesMetroOpera.org. We have a beautiful website full of wonderful things to look at and lots of information. So you can get ticket information and other event information at the website. Or you can always call 961-6221. 515-961-6221, where a live person will answer the phone and will give you information as to how to secure tickets or other information you might need.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Well, as I mentioned, the ticket sales are at record highs for us this year, and so people shouldn't wait. Your peers are buying tickets earlier and earlier, so you don't want to be left out in the cold, missing your seats. Several performance dates are sold out already, but there are tickets available for every opera on certain dates yet at this point. So I wouldn't wait much longer. If you don't already have your seats, I would get them soon.
Thanks for today's Des Moines Metro Opera sneak peek goes to IPR's John Pemble, Tony Daner, and Alexis Hahn. And a big thank you to the Des Moines Metro Opera's general and artistic director and one of the major movers and shakers on this nationally recognized and respected opera company, Michael Eagle. And thank you so much for coming in today, Michael.
Oh, thank you.